Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, suicide bombers in Baghdad today strike four targets in just 45 minutes. Paul Bremer says the U.S. is still in it for the long haul.
We're moving ahead with our plan. We'll have rough days, such as we've had the last couple of days, but the overall thrust is in the right direction, and the good days outnumber the bad days, and that's the thing we need to keep in perspective.
There's good news on the U.S. economy. Many wage earners are getting bigger paychecks.
Adopted children are found starving in a New Jersey home. Why didn't the visiting caseworker find them first?
Also, couples with girls rather than boys divorce more. Bad for girls and also bad for the economy.
These stories and Roberta Flack on Alicia Keys coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Huge wildfires in Southern California with flames fanned by strong Santa Ana winds have destroyed more than 825 homes so far and killed at least 13 people. The blazes are threatening an estimated 30,000 homes. San Diego Mayor Dick Murphy is urging businesses in the city to send workers home today.
This is as much for the benefit of firefighting as the safety of their employees. We need today to conserve electricity. We need to keep people off the roads. People should be indoors for health reasons. The air quality is obviously very poor.
Murphy is also calling people in San Diego to conserve water. The sky over much of Southern California is dimmed by smoke and ash from the blazes, which have spread over about 500 square miles of dense, dry brush and trees. Suicide bombers attacked the Red Cross headquarters in Baghdad today, as well as three police stations, killing about 40 people and injuring more than 200 others. It was the bloodiest attack yet during the U.S.-led occupation of the city and occurred on the first day of the Islamic holy month of fasting, Ramadan. NPR's Jackie Lydon in Baghdad reports the string of car bombings occurred within a 45-minute period.
In two cases, witnesses said, the vehicles used were actually identical to those used by the facilities attacked. Iraqis say it's the work of foreigners, and there was, in police custody, a man with a Syrian passport who was foiled in his attempt to bomb yet another police station. I don't know what's happening to us, one civilian said, as the first day of Ramadan ended with a somber mood in Baghdad. Jackie Lydon, NPR News, Baghdad.
President Bush says the latest attacks in Iraq are acts of desperation in reaction to the progress being made by U.S. forces.
This government is determined to hear the call from the Iraqi. And the call is they want a society in which their children can go to school, in which they can get good health care, in which they're able to live a peaceful life. It's in the national interest of the United States that a peaceful Iraq emerge. And we will stay the course.
Mr. Bush speaking to reporters at the White House. Former Washington, D.C. Mayor Walter Washington has died. From member station WAMU, James Jones reports.
Washington was the first African-American to head a major U.S. city. He was tapped by President Lyndon Johnson to lead a capital that had been run by an appointed commission dominated by white Southerners. He emerged as a national leader following riots in 1968 that were sparked by the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Washington died after a long illness. He was 88. For NPR News, I'm James Jones in Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 39 points at 9,621, the Nasdaq up 10 at 1876. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks are holding on to narrow gains today on the strength of positive economic numbers, plus word of some major mergers. Sales of previously owned homes rose 3.6% last month to a new record. At the same time, sales of new single-family homes dipped 0.2%, but remain at a relatively high level. Both numbers exceeded analyst expectations. Bank of America shares have been trading down 10% after Bank of America announced a $47 billion takeover of Fleet Boston Financial. Contract talks between grocery store workers and managers in Arizona are on hold. The two sides have agreed to extend their negotiations on a contract that was scheduled to expire over the weekend. From member station KXJZ in Phoenix, Mark Moran reports.
14,000 members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union are threatening to strike against the management of two of Arizona's largest supermarket chains, Safeway and Fry's, which is owned by Kroger. They disagree with managers over wages, health and pension benefits, Sunday overtime, and pay for new hires. The current labor deal was scheduled to expire late Saturday night, but the two sides agreed to extend it into November. Some labor analysts say the two sides in Arizona are waiting to see how the 70,000 union workers on strike in California will resolve the same sticking points. California grocery workers walked off the job or were locked out of the stores 2 weeks ago. Managers there hired replacement workers prior to the strike, a step Arizona grocers were preparing to take before the two sides extended their contract deadline. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
A new survey finds that the mood of investors is more upbeat than it was the previous month. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Today was the bloodiest day in Iraq since the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime in April. Car bombs struck the International Red Cross headquarters and three police stations in Baghdad, killing 40 people and wounding more than 200. And this was a day after a U.S. colonel died in a rocket attack on the Al-Rashid Hotel, where one guest was Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz. President Bush met in the Oval Office this morning with the top U.S. civil official in Iraq, Paul Bremer. Here's the president speaking about the insurgency in Iraq.
They hate freedom. They love terror. They love to try to create fear and chaos. We're determined in this administration is not to be intimidated by these killers. And as a matter of fact, we're even more determined to work with the Iraqi people to create the conditions of freedom and peace, because it's in our national interest we do so.
Well, joining us to discuss now the meeting between Bush and Bremer is L.A. Times Washington reporter Jim Gerstenzang. Jim, welcome.
Hello.
Jim, we just heard a bit about this morning's press conference. What else was said in the Oval Office?
The thing to keep in mind is that the president and Paul Bremer are trying their best to keep the focus, at least in public, on every sign of progress they can find. Bremer added in the Oval Office as he was talking to reporters that his comments were basically that nothing untoward had occurred. He said a lot of wonderful things have happened in Iraq since July. So they're really trying to keep the focus on the positive, almost ignoring the death and destruction that is being reported every day.
Jim, dark news though from Iraq. Do you sense any strain in the president more than usual?
No, he's just back from Asia, of course. And acknowledging he's a bit jet lagged, and he's about to start out at midweek on a trip to it'll take him to Texas, but day trips doing political campaigning almost every day, and he is very much focused on November a year from now.
Did you feel at all? What's the word? Spun? This was a very, very bad day for us in Iraq. And the president, as you say, was almost sunny.
This is absolutely spin. Yes, there's the language about the cold blood killers and the terrorists. This is language that he's certainly comfortable using. But he's presenting this in terms of how the Iraqi people really know that it's just a handful of people who don't want them to live in freedom, he says, who don't want their children to go to school, and so on. So he just keeps this focus, almost like a broken record we've been hearing, on what has happened that's gone well, and present the downside as just a few malcontents, is almost the way he's saying it.
Jim, is there any chat among the reporters who cover this president every day that there could be a point of diminishing returns when the positive spin just isn't working anymore as the drip, drip, drip of death in Iraq continues?
I don't see any particular sign that it is working at all, but this is the way this administration has conducted itself right from the start and even during the campaign of 2000, to keep focusing on its message day after day after day and just not acknowledge that there's anything, that there's another side to that message.
On Message in the Bush White House, Jim Gerstenzang, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jim Gerstenzang covers Washington for the LA Times.
Well, U.S. military officials are saying that today's bombings were probably the work of foreign fighters, not Saddam loyalists. For more on this, we turn to Dareed Issa. He's a freelance journalist working for Western news agencies. And, Dareed, what is your speculation as to why the Red Cross in particular would be targeted?
Well, the Red Cross in particular, because the belief is that foreign fighters have done that fight. So the belief is that it's got to do with Islamic fundamentalists. That's why the significance is that for the cross. These consider the American occupation in Iraq as a crusade, and that's their way of retaliating for that.
Because of the cross and the Red Cross, as opposed to the crescent in the Arab version, which is the Red Crescent organization.
True. This is very true. This is very true. And not to forget that one of the assailants who did not succeed in accomplishing his attack today was a Syrian who was captured by the Iraqi police.
So are you agreeing with the speculation that these were foreign fighters, not Saddam loyalists?
Yes, because the general feeling on the street and the people that I met and talked to around, they were all angry and mad, especially for the attack against the Red Cross, because they were saying that this is a humanitarian organization, that it's got nothing to do with politics, it's got nothing to do with any regime or any system, and that shouldn't have happened.
But today was the first day of Ramadan. The U.S. forces, by the way, had lifted curfews. We read reports that civilians have been out in the streets, life looking a little bit more normal. Why would these attackers attack today? It would seem like a terrible public relations move on their part.
True, but if we look at these guys as Islamic fundamentalists and all that stuff, Robin, you would understand that they would take that day to be a significant day to wage some sort of jihad or a holy war against the crusaders, as they would refer to Westerners.
One last question before you go. How would you characterize the public mood in Baghdad right now? Is there more anger against these so-called foreign fighters or the foreign U.S.
Yes.
soldiers? Which would
no,
you say?
No, there is more. There is more anger at the foreign fighters, because a lot of people that I've heard were saying, like, we're fasting and we're around here in a month of God, in a holy month of time. And these men don't seem to fear God, because all these attacks are targeting Iraqis. We don't know who these guys are targeting right now, or who are they waging their war against, because throughout the over 30 dead people today, there were only two U.S. soldiers.
Dareed, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert.
Dareed Issa is an Iraqi journalist working for Western news agencies in Baghdad.
There are still more than 9 million unemployed people in the United States. But the good news is that people who are working are making a bit more money. According to Labor Department data analyzed at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., hourly wages are up more than 2%, which amounts to a median wage of about $14 an hour. But are we spending that 2%? Joining us on the line is Larry Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute. And Larry, why have wages gone up?
Well, it could be that they're just not hiring the lower wage workers, that those are the people that are losing their jobs, having their jobs outsourced. Could be partly due to a dip in inflation. Wage growth is affected dramatically by the levels of unemployment, and as the higher as unemployment has risen, wage growth always slows down, and it takes a while when unemployment falls for wage growth to pick up again. So I think it's a little bit early to see wage growth improve. It will be a boost to the economy, and the economy could really need it, because, you know, we've been bleeding jobs for 2.5 years.
It's a confusing picture out there. Many forecasters expecting that the Commerce Department will announce later this week that the economy's grown by about 6% in the last 3 months. That's the fastest pace since 1999. Is that all good, or is there a downside? What's the scenario, rosy or not?
It's true that we've experienced some very fast growth in the last quarter. I think it's already become slower than what it was in that time period. And it's great. What we really need is that kind of growth sustained for many months so that employers will start investing in equipment and machinery and hire people. We've only seen 1 month of positive job growth in a long while, and that was only 57,000 jobs, which is far short of the 170,000 jobs a month we need just to absorb a growing population, just to absorb new workers.
You're an economist. You follow this stuff really closely. It sounds to me like you're not making any predictions more than 3 months out. Yeah, the economy might spin a little faster for a while, but what happens after that seems to be mysterious to you and many other economists that I read.
Well, I think that, you know, we can expect some moderate growth over the next year, and I focus on what happens to working families and workers, and I think the unemployment rate will probably stay at or above 6%, and we will create at best a modest number of jobs. So we're going to hear a lot about how the economy has recovered, established good growth. Some of that is true, but it's going to take a while before it's firmly established and that people will actually experience some of the improvements in the economy. And I'm not sure when it'll happen. It might not happen fast enough to help George Bush get reelected, or it might. So we'll have to wait and see.
We will have to wait and see. Larry Mischel, president of the Economic Policy Institute, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
At least 13 people have died in the worst wildfires in California in a decade. Thousands more have been uprooted and rerouted. Airline travel is disrupted, and the Monday night football game moved from San Diego to Arizona. The fires, fanned by the hot Santa Ana winds, stretch from the Mexican border to the suburbs north of Los Angeles. Mary Justine Lanyon of Lake Arrowhead, California, fled her mountain home on Saturday and has been taking shelter with hundreds of other families in the Sultana High School in nearby Hesperia. She joins us on the line. And Mary Justine, why did you evacuate?
Saturday night, the police were driving around the mountain roads on their bullhorns, telling everybody that they had to leave.
Yeah. So I understand that your child is not there, thankfully, but
you had
two cats. Were you able to take them as well?
We took our cats. We didn't know where we were going. We each were in a car. And as we're driving, my husband found an AM station out of Apple Valley. And I'd like to say it's station 960 and give them a huge amount of credit because they're the only ones who've been giving us information of what to do and where to go.
Well, what is that like? I mean, you just wandering around aimlessly in your car? I mean, that's got to be nerve-wracking.
I figured I was going to sleep in the car, but this radio station said if you have animals, go to PetSmart in Victorville, and then the radio station told us to come to this high school. The most frustrating thing is that we are having a lot of trouble getting accurate information. There are wild rumors flying everywhere. The best as we can tell is that the fire has not gotten to Lake Arrowhead yet, and we're hoping that it won't. It's pretty much stopped in Crestline. So we hope that our house is okay. Yeah. It's the first house that we've ever bought, and I just got here in California 6 weeks ago. I moved here from New Jersey. Quite an introduction to the West Coast.
Yeah. I know you have insurance for your house, but what did you leave behind that you're thinking about, and what did you take?
What I left behind was my photo album with my wedding pictures and the pictures of the birth of my daughter. I wish I had taken that. I just took a little bit of clothes, birth certificates, passports, those sorts of things, so I grabbed that.
Yeah. Do you have any sense of when you may be able to go home?
We're guessing right now that we'll be here at least another 48 hours, but they're not telling us. Nobody's going to work, nobody's going to school, but the good thing here is the sense of community. I just said to someone last night, there are no hotel rooms available, but even if one opened up, I wouldn't go. I'd stay here because we've created. I'm sitting here with my new friend Sandy and her two children, Kelly and Carrie, and it's like they're my new family. That we're all in the same boat, so we're all supporting each other. So the mood is very upbeat because we're holding each other up there.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Mary Justine Lanyon. She joined us from a shelter in Hesperia, California.
Just ahead, the political dynamics of the economy in Iraq, Democrats push back.
And later in the program, researchers say families with girls are a little more likely to wind up in divorce court than those with only boys.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Even just a few weeks ago, the president looked politically vulnerable on both the economy and his management of post-war Iraq. But now some economic numbers are on the upswing, while the body count in Iraq continues to worsen. The war seems to be giving Democrats the most political traction at the moment, however dangerous. Even ghoulish it can get for politicians to, in effect, react to more bad news from a war zone as good news for their political agenda. Joining us on the line now are members of our D.C. roundtable. Bill Douglas covers the White House for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us, Bill. And Andrea Stone covers Congress for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Bill.
Andrea, is bad news from Iraq good news for Democrats?
Well, you know, Democrats would never want to make hay off of soldiers being killed every day. But in the last few weeks, we have seen on Capitol Hill the Democrats have been making strides, which is kind of surprising because they are in the minority in both the House and the Senate. And yet there's been a series of small and not-so-small victories legislatively. Last week, there were a few victories that the Democrats had. They managed to defeat limits on class action lawsuits, which is a very important issue to Democrats. They also, despite a presidential veto threat, voted with other with Republicans to overturn the ban on travel to Cuba. And they also, in the House, it was mostly a symbolic vote, but there was a vote in the House with Democrats and some Republicans basically saying that the $10 billion of the $20 billion that the United States is going to give Iraq for reconstruction should be a loan, and again, under a presidential veto threat. So with the help of some more moderate Republicans and also some fiscally conservative Republicans who are really worried about the deficit, Democrats are making a little headway.
So, Bill, here's a president who you cover who was so high in the approval ratings not so long ago, now facing this kind of cobbled together pseudo-coalition almost of Democrats and some moderate Republicans, not giving him everything he wants. How's the White House handling that?
They have their good days and bad days. There's frustration here. There is a degree of anger at some Republicans on the Hill for not going along with the White House agenda. I mean, you had Senator Lugar speaking out about he hears three different voices coming from the White House on Iraq, those being the president, the secretary of state, and the vice president.
So, Bill, when you see the president, as we just did and discussed earlier in the program, at the White House this morning, spinning even a fairly catastrophic couple of days in Iraq as still being a situation that's primarily about good news, is that working for him politically, do you think, or is that dangerous?
Yes, on both. It is dangerous. It does resonate with hardcore Bush supporters. Mm. It further emboldens those who don't like the president that they're trying to hide something.
Yeah. Now, Andrea, the nine Democratic candidates for president had their fifth televised debate last night. They're all united in attacking President Bush on Iraq, but they were attacking each other, too, weren't they?
Right. I mean, last night they were just going—it was nasty. It some points. I think so there's some frustration among the presidential candidates that they've got nine people on these debates and that there's very little time for each of them to speak, let alone to make an impression. So when they do get their turn, they really go, you know, in some cases last night, really went for the jugular.
Bill, do you have a sense that the White House is worried politically at this point about any of these nine Democrats?
Well, I mean, they look at numbers. Right now, some polls have a nondescript generic Democrat slightly ahead of the president. The president fares better when you actually put a real Democrat,
exactly.
a Gephardt or a Dean up there. So, yeah, they're concerned. They realize that, you know, contrary to popular belief, this reelection campaign is not going to be a cakewalk.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The last few days, the economic news has been pretty good, which has to hearten the White House.
And a lot of Americans are a little uncomfortable with the $87 billion price tag for reconstruction.
Bill, Iraq got very personal for the White House this weekend when Assistant Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz was just one floor away from where a rocket hit the Al-Rashid Hotel and killed a colonel. Any sense in Washington this morning from out of the White House or the Pentagon that people were particularly rattled by that close call?
Not yet. I mean, in this morning's briefing, Scott McClellan deflected all the questions over to the Pentagon. I think they're going to try their best to put on a public face to ensure that this is not seen as personal.
You know, I have to just chime in here a minute. You know, I was in Iraq in July, and the Al-Rashid is, you know, you can see it from where the main headquarters is. And you have to go through, you know, three checkpoints, barbed wire, concrete barriers. It's almost a quarter of a mile, it almost seems, to walk in there. And yet, that's still not safe enough to protect from rockets and mortars that can travel 2, 3, 4 miles.
Yeah, exactly. One heard over the weekend a military officer in Iraq saying, well, this was very low-tech stuff.
Well, look, I mean, you know, a colonel, we don't know the name, but a colonel was killed by this low-tech stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, low-tech stuff can do damage.
Bill, we referred earlier in our conversation to the $87 billion aid for Iraq bill. The president is actually threatening to veto that bill, his own bill, isn't he, if any of the money is made into loans, not grants. Where does that all stand?
Well, he's hoping it doesn't come down to that. This morning he was very adamant, almost testy about that, and he repeated 2, 3 times that his preference, his strong desire is to have this in the form of grants and not loans. So I'm sure in the coming days, now that they're back from Asia, you'll see some White House pressure over on the Hill to make sure that these are indeed grants and not loans.
Right. Plus, they didn't get anywhere near the amount of money that the World Bank says they need for rebuilding.
That was the other thing you saw this morning when Paul Bremer and President Bush were in the Oval Office presenting the $13 billion or so that they got in Madrid as quite an accomplishment. And, in fact, it's not as much as they wanted.
It's not. And they're going to need more, or else this administration is going to have to go back and add on to that $87 billion, which I'm sure they don't want to do.
Right. They said they wanted $35 billion in addition to the $20 that we were going to give. So they got a long way to go.
The battle of the messages over Iraq and the economy. We'll be following it for months now. I want to thank you both. Andrea Stone covers Congress for USA Today. Thanks a lot, Andrea.
Thank you, Bill.
And Bill Douglas covers the White House for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, ever heard of Friendster? Well, you may have more friends than you thought, at least in cyberspace.
And ballerina Jennifer Gelfand of the Boston Ballet hangs up her pointe shoes at the tender age of 31. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A New Jersey couple is arrested, charged with starving their adopted sons, even as social workers checked in on them.
Couples with daughters rather than sons are more likely to divorce, and the economic effects are far-reaching.
If you're in a single-parent family, you're about 2 to 3 times more likely to be in poverty, about twice as likely to drop out of high school, and you're much more likely to be jobless as a young adult.
And legendary singer Roberta Flack on advice she gives to legends in the making like Alicia Keys and Lauryn Hill, and on her own rise to stardom.
Robin, when I first started to sing, somebody did a big review on me, and this man called me the Black Judy Garland. How do you like that?
Coming up Here and Now. I'm Dolores Handy. In Iraq, it has been the bloodiest day in Baghdad since the fall of Saddam Hussein. A string of car bombings took place all within 1 hour, killing nearly 40 people, including one American soldier. The blast at the International Red Cross headquarters and police stations across the capital came after 3 U.S. soldiers were killed in separate incidents overnight. Leaders the world over are expressing outrage over the Baghdad attacks. The European Union decried the incidents, especially the strike against the International Red Cross. France is condemning it and says a key to combating such violence is to restore sovereignty to the country. Germany's condemnation said the attacks were against the interest of the Iraqi people. Israel strikes back following attacks by Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon. Lebanese security officials say guerrillas shelled Israeli positions in a disputed southern Lebanese border area for the first time in 2 months today. Israel responded with airstrikes and heavy artillery fire. There's been no word on casualties. President Bush is vowing to help California fight its raging wildfires. Mark Smith has the latest.
The president has dispatched Mike Brown, head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to California, while other top aides have been consulting by phone with Governor Gray Davis and the state's congressional delegation. The goal, Bush says, is to provide all resources necessary to battle the blazes.
We want to help put them out. I mean, this is a devastating fire, and it's a dangerous fire, and we're prepared to help in any way we can.
And during an Oval Office meeting on Iraq, Bush told reporters he's getting regular updates on the deadly flames, which have blackened tens of thousands of acres between the Mexican border and the L.A. suburbs and destroyed hundreds of homes. Mark Smith at the White House.
Bank of America, the third largest bank in the United States, will buy seventh-ranked Fleet Boston in a $47 billion deal, creating the second biggest banking company in the U.S. Bank of America says the acquisition will give it about 33 million customers and 2.5 million business clients in the U.S. and 34 countries. The agreement is subject to regulatory and shareholder approval. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are up. The Dow is up 45 points at 96.28. The NASDAQ is up 12 points at 18.77. And the S&P 500 is up 3 points at 10.32. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Imagine a 19-year-old, only 4 feet tall, weighing just 45 pounds. A young man, police said, looked like a 10-year-old child. Then imagine how a caseworker for New Jersey's foster care system could have failed to notice the young man's condition despite 38 visits over 2 years to the teenager's adopted family. And it gets worse. The same adoptive parents who allegedly starved the 19-year-old also starved three other boys, allegedly, under their roof. Lydia Polgreen is a staff writer for The New York Times who's been following this story. She joins me now on the line. Hi, Lydia.
Hi, Bill.
Lydia, Raymond Jackson and his wife, Vanessa, you've been out to Collingswood, New Jersey, where this happened. Tell me about these people.
Their friends and neighbors say that they are devout, born-again Christians. They are. They say that they adopted these children who had developmental problems, health problems, because they felt that it was their duty to take care of God's children. Investigators, however, paint a very different picture of the Jacksons. They say that the Jacksons adopted these children, accepted $28,000 a year in stipends from the state, and kept them from food, did not allow them to go to school, did not provide them with medical care.
How was the alleged starvation finally discovered?
The eldest boy, Bruce, the 19-year-old, was found rummaging through a neighbor's trash can at about 2:30 in the morning on October 10th. The neighbor called the police, and when the police arrived, they thought that Bruce was a 10-year-old boy because he's so slight in stature. After speaking to him, they went into the house and discovered there were three other boys who were in similarly bad condition, and there were also three girls living in the home, but they appeared to be well taken care of and in relatively good health.
Lydia, what do we know about how they were deprived of food if the two girls in the home were being fed?
It appears that the boys were locked out, that the kitchen was kept locked, and that they were fed a meager diet of raw pancake batter, breakfast cereals, cream of wheat, and oatmeal, and peanut butter and jelly, and that was all that they were allowed to eat. The kitchen doors were locked, and apparently, according to the prosecutor in Camden County, the boys were persuaded that they had an eating disorder, and two of the boys had, in fact, had eating problems when they were little children. But the prosecutor said that their later medical examination of the boys determined that those problems could have been solved if they had received proper medical attention.
What is the sense of how a caseworker could have missed all this over a period of 2 years and apparently 38 visits to the home?
It's unclear. At first, there were questions as to whether the caseworker actually went to the home, but it appears from interviews with neighbors that the state car would come on a regular basis, which is why actually neighbors did not call social services when seeing these extremely thin and gaunt children. Prosecutor did say that the children knew the social worker by name. At least some of the children knew the social worker by name and had interacted with her. So it's clear that at least based on the prosecutor's statements, that the social worker did have contact with the children.
The parents now charged with aggravated assault. Lydia, just to finish up, what's the state of the young men now?
The young men were taken out of the home. They were all hospitalized. The oldest remains hospitalized. It's extraordinary. The youngest, the 14-year-old boy, whose name was given as KJ, weighed just 40 pounds when he was taken from the home. He had weighed 38 pounds when he was adopted in 1996. On October 23rd, when he was released from the hospital after 13 days, he weighed 47 pounds. So he gained 7 pounds just in that very brief period of time.
Lydia Polgrain is a staff writer for The New York Times. Thanks very much, Lydia.
Thank you.
Well, if true, the charges against the Jackson family are, of course, obscene. And on a completely different note, they also run counter to the current thinking that more American parents favor boys over girls, to the extent that a child's gender may be a factor in a family staying together. Economists at the University of California at Berkeley studied divorce rates, and the results are astonishing. Couples with girls are more likely to get divorced than those with boys. Joining us on the line is co-author of the study, Gordon Dahl, currently professor of economics at the University of Rochester. And professor, give us the statistics. You started with couples with one girl and those with one boy. What did you find?
Yes, we find that couples with one girl versus one boy, actually this is the mother, she's about 5.5% more likely to be divorced or separated. This effect only grows as you get a larger family size. So for families with two girls versus two boys, the effect is 8% bigger divorce or separation rates. Families with three or four, the numbers rise to 10 and 13% respectively.
Do we know why this is?
Well, I think that there are a variety of theories. What we have is just data which shows who's separated or divorced, and we don't have necessarily explanations from the people why they're separated, of course.
Well, others have weighed in on that. The thinking might be that a father might stay through a difficult marriage to be with his sons. A mother might tolerate a bad marriage so that her sons will have a father. So there are many reasons why. But what were you trying to find out through this study?
We were trying to find out if parents prefer boys versus girls, as they do in many developing countries. And we thought maybe one way to do that would be to see whether or not mothers were more likely to be divorced if they had a girl versus a boy as their first child.
But what would this have to do with the economy?
Economists have started studying family research and indeed all sorts of other researches as well. We don't care just about how much a woman contributes to her family's finances, but also how she interacts with her kids, how dads interact with their kids. The direct link for kids, of course, is that if you're in a single-parent family, you're about 2 to 3 times more likely to be in poverty, about twice as likely to drop out of high school, and you're much more likely to be jobless as a young adult.
And we understand that when there is a boy in a home, the parents put more money into that home. They spend an additional $600 a year on housing, according to other studies, and they tend to work more.
Yes, Shelley Lundberg at the University of Washington, along with some co-authors, Elena Rose and Sarah McClanahan, did some of this work. And they find that the extra work that the parents do is not taken out of time spent with the family, but rather out of leisure.
Professor, we've long known that this is the case in China and India, to the extent that there's an imbalance between the girls and the boys. But what do we see in the U.S. as far as people choosing whether or not to have a boy or a girl?
Well, so sex selection technologies right now are very expensive, but I think it raises important ethical questions. In India and China, people are using sonograms and then selectively aborting female fetuses, which I think is a horrible state of affairs. In the U.S., we did some interesting research, and we saw that if you had a sonogram and you had a girl, you were actually less likely to be married at birth. Now, while this isn't as mind-boggling as female infanticide, it does show up what I think is an interesting pattern. If you know that you're going to have a girl, you're slightly less likely to be married when the child is born.
And many people are concerned in this country that now with technology, people can, through in vitro fertilization, select a gender for their child, and people are worried about the outcome of that. Well, Professor, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you very much.
Gordon Dahl is Professor of Economics at the University of Rochester. For more on his study, go to our website, here-now.org.
Still to come, singer Roberta Flack, musical mentor to some of today's pop stars, and a whole lot more.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Hollywood's so concerned about the ever more skillful pirating of its products by teenagers that it's decided to send emissaries into grade schools and middle schools to get out the message that if you haven't paid for it, it's stealing. The Motion Picture Association of America has given a grant of $100,000 to Junior Achievement Incorporated, which Senior Vice President of Education at Junior Achievement, Dr. Daryl Luzzo, is now on the line to explain. Welcome, Doctor.
Hello.
How widespread is pirating among teens? How much money does it cost Hollywood?
You know, the estimates vary depending on the particular group that puts together the survey and analysis, but we're aware that it's billions of dollars a year overall. The percentage of that that involves teens is hard to sometimes figure out, although we have found in the classrooms that we've gone into that many, many students do talk about the fact that they, in fact, are participating in downloading activities themselves.
What is Junior Achievement, just briefly?
Junior Achievement is a volunteer organization that really inspires children to learn about the economics of life through what we call free enterprise education. One of the things that we are focusing on in recent years is the importance, particularly within this age of increasing corporate scandal, to talk about business ethics and the importance of a good, solid ethical nature within the business community.
Now, how many kids do you hope to reach? Is this a nationwide program, and when does it all get started?
It is a nationwide program that got underway just a week or so ago. We hope to reach upwards of nearly 1 million students. It's a program that will be delivered throughout the country.
Doctor, just telling kids something's wrong, kind of a just-say-no approach, doesn't always have the best track record with kids. I hear there are some anti-pirating incentives in all this.
incentives are not really a part of this program. What we do is have a contest to allow the children to extend their learning beyond the classroom by going home and chatting with parents and other friends. And then,
well, what is this contest?
What is the contest? We call it the Excellent Extreme Challenge. And what children are asked to do is, in 500 words or less, come up with an essay about how they think that they can best inform their peers about the issues.
It is a competition, though, right? You can win DVD players and movie tickets and good stuff like that.
Yeah, the incentive, if you will, there, in your reference earlier to incentives, is simply a motivation to get the kids to continue thinking about the issue beyond the brief visit to the classroom that the program provides.
Yeah. Well, the name of the program is What's the Diff? A Guide to Digital Citizenship. And I guess the diff is that you get yourself in a lot of trouble for pirating, and you're trying to get that message out to kids.
That's exactly what we're trying to do. We believe that we have a great opportunity with our business volunteers coming in the classroom to not only educate but inspire the children to at least think again. Part of what we call good citizenship, which is an important part of our nature here at Junior Achievement.
Dr. Daryl Luzzo has been on the line discussing Junior Achievement's movement into fifth grade classes to eighth grade classes to teach about reasons not to pirate. Dr. Daryl Luzzo, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The first time ever I saw your face.
Instantly recognizable, isn't it? Roberta Flack's recording of The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face became a mega hit and helped establish this classically trained former music teacher as one of the premier voices of a generation. But Roberta Flack can talk as well as sing. She had her own radio show for years, has strong opinions, and the resume to back them up. Flack travels to Boston this week to promote her new holiday CD and to appear at Stepping Out 2003, a benefit for the Dimmock Community Health Center. So we decided to catch up with her when we could catch our breath.
Your face, your face, your face.
You are at the center of so many legendary music industry stories. Do you mind if we look back just for a second and separate?
I want to hear what they are.
Well, you've heard them. That your hit song, First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, was released in 1969, but it didn't become the super hit that it was until Clint Eastwood put it on Play Misty for Me 3 years later.
Well, yes, that was such an honor, Robin, and certainly if he had not done that, I don't know where I would be, probably still teaching.
But how could an industry miss The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face?
Oh, listen, Robin, how much time do you have? How much time do you have? You're talking to someone who's been through the mill when it comes to missing, people missing.
How could the industry miss my last album?
That was 1994's Roberta. So what happens? Do you feel they don't market it? Do they dismiss?
I know. Of course they don't market it. If I'm not hipping and hopping and shaking my booty, you know. Listen, the thing is, I also don't want to sound angry when I say this, so people don't misunderstand me. Music is probably the one guaranteed evolving thing in all of our lives. It will change. And so if first time ever I saw your face was recorded in 69, that's a few years ago. And if people are still playing it on the radio, isn't that absolutely phenomenal? Robin, when I first started to sing, somebody did a big review on me. And this man called me the Black Judy Garland. How do you like that? If you listen to that hype and you believe it, where in the heck would I be? Trying to sound like somewhere, you know, like Judy Garland or whatever, a black version. I don't know what that would sound like, you know. Right. Maybe Mahalia Jackson when she was very well rested or something. But I don't know, Robin. I don't have any concern about what the record companies or the industry, how they label me or how they label other people. Alicia Keys is like my little new goddaughter. And Alicia Keys talks to me all the time. She's trying to do her second album. I know those folks think she should have been finished, but Alicia's taking her time.
I wanted to ask you about that because I wonder which young artists are looking to you. I mean, one in particular, I'm thinking of Lauryn Hill with the Fugees. They did a cover.
Killing Me Softly and sold 17 million albums based on their cover of the song. But he just kept right on.
Do you ever find yourself giving advice to any of these other women who have had incredible superstardom? I'm thinking of Norah Jones or Lauryn Hill. And by the way, whatever they have, to put it in perspective for younger people, it doesn't even come close to how big some of your hits were. Do you find yourself either, you know, talking directly to them or thinking for them, here's what you need to watch out for?
Yeah, I do that with Alicia. That's why I mentioned that. She calls me all the time.
Yeah, what do you tell her? What does she ask you?
I tell her to keep her eyes on the prize, you know, and to read Maya Angelou's book, Maya Angelou's poem, And Still I Rise, because you have, as a woman, black woman, young, gorgeous, mixed, interracial, who can sing Donny Hathaway, Someday We'll All Be Free, and then turn around and do Princess, How Come You Don't Call Me Anymore.
Tell me, baby, 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 why you wanna go and break my heart? Hey, ooh, all I wanna know is, baby, what we had was good. How come you don't call me anymore?
I think she's brilliant, and I said to her, you know, Alicia, remember what you did. Don't ever forget what you've already done. And that's like the springboard for where you're going to go next. You're at the free throw line. It's like in the old days of the NBA when people got a chance to go to the free throw line. Remember, they used to make you be quiet. Or in tennis. Remember when tennis used to be... Everybody's now listening to see what Alicia is going to do. She's at that free throw line. She can do anything she wants to. That's what I tell them. And Lauryn Hill, I just love to pieces and smithereens. Because she is Lauryn, and she reminds me a lot of myself when I was her age, not only in terms of her energy and her spiritual focus, but also of her voice and her attitude about music. So those are the kids. I mean, do you know who DJ Premier is?
I don't.
DJ Premier is a hip-hop mixer supreme. I found out that he was remixing some of Quincy Jones' hits, and I said, oh. But he and I are talking about digging up some of that stuff that Donny Hathaway and I did that wasn't released and fixing it, making it available for the kids, who, by the way, worship Donny Hathaway.
You both went to Howard University together.
Howard. We like to say Harvard because it sounds like you're saying Harvard. But we went to Harvard University, yes.
Yes, you did.
One of the reasons I don't like to do interviews is for the same reason that Clint doesn't and Quincy doesn't. You get tired of answering the same questions over and over and over again. I don't want to talk about you were born, you went, you grew. You know, I'd rather talk about things like the new artist. And so if you need to shut me up. Say, Roberta, okay, I'm going to move on.
Well, first of all, if anyone ever hears me saying, shut up, Roberta Flack, move on. Then
no, it's okay. You can say that to me.
I'm done. No, I
know. No, I would say that to people I interviewed when I was on the radio.
I'm going to do something that you just said that you hate, but I want to do just this one last old question, if you will. The perhaps urban myth, perhaps true, number two. Did you really write Killing Me Softly for Don McLean?
Of course not.
Oh, the story is that you wrote Killing Me Softly for Don McLean of American Pie fame after seeing him sing in a small club.
There used to be these brochures on the plane that told you what you were going to listen to. They were featuring a girl named Laura Lieberman.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style. And so I came to see him to listen for a while.
When I got off the plane, I called Quincy at his house and I said, Q, I just heard the world's most wonderful song. He said, oh, I know them. And I had the song within a day and a half. But while I was listening to her sing, I heard my voice.
Singing my life with his words. Killing me softly with his song. Killing me softly with his song.
This young lady went to hear Don McLean at a club in L.A. called the Troubadour. So it's all about Don McLean, but no, I did not write it. And do I wish I had?
Yes. Roberta Flack, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Roberta Flack. She'll be appearing at Stepping Out 2003 in Boston on Saturday. She spoke to Here Now from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City.
Singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
Ever heard of Friendster? Well, you may have more friends than you thought, at least in cyberspace.
And Jennifer Gelfand of the Boston Ballet hangs up her pointe shoes at the tender age of 31.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.